We're going to continue with our study of Locke today, but I'm going to pause to just review a few things and contrast him to the rationalists whom we already finished. In particular, I'm thinking of Leibniz, because Leibniz understands Locke to be saying that since all our information comes through our senses, and that's how ideas enter our minds, that he is ruling out the very notion that an axiom or a universal truth could be self-evident to someone. And so to do this little review, I want to first consider the idea of self-evidence. First of all, it was defined very well by Aristotle as consisting of two things. There are two characteristics that distinguish self-evidence. First, that whatever is self-evident to us looks to be so, and we say, on the face of it. That is, the immediate experience of one and one is two convinces me it's true and that it can't be false. As long as we're talking about whole numbers, natural number system, not doing something funny by switching definitions on us or anything like that, then on the face of it, it hits me as completely true. Now, the second thing is, I'm going to call that prima facie true, an expression we use also in the law. And the second characteristic is that the self-evident truth is not inferred from other information. Those are the two main characteristics. Now, I want to point out right away that from the standpoint of our experience, at any rate, it's not just propositions and statements and theories that can look self-evident or not. All day, every day, everyone sees the world around them and believes that their perception of it is conveying to them the way things are. When I come to an intersection and look up the street to see if any other car is coming, and I see nothing coming, it's self-evident to me that nothing's coming. Experiences of states of affairs are self-evident as to their reality, which is why we consider realistic dreams and hallucinations as counter instances to self-evidence. They are experiences that would normally be self-evident but are not. So we need a way to distinguish them. That part's true. But that's not what happened to this idea of self-evidence as it was developed in the ancient world. And it was defined this way and championed by no less than Aristotle. But at the same time, Aristotle wants to put restrictions on it. Restrictions on it. I'll talk about why you wanted to do that after you see what they are. First is, everyone who is an expert in the field in which the, and I'll do this for self-evident, in which the self-evident truth is experienced, agrees It is self-evident. He's willing to grant that some people who are totally uneducated might be confronted with a, let's say, a proposition, a mathematical formula or a logical proposition stated, which an expert could tell is self-evidently true, but the average potato farmer is not going to get it. So he wants to say an expert in the field in which this truth, purported truth, arises. So if it's philosophical, he wants all the philosophers to agree. If it's something physical, all the physicists should agree. If it's something in astronomy, all the astronomers should agree. Now, why do you think he wanted to do that? We'll come to that in a moment. We're going to look at the others. All the experts in the field in which the self-evident truth arises agree it is self-evident. Secondly, it is a law. A necessary truth. We understand laws as being statements of truths that are necessary. So what does necessary mean? It means it's not in fact true this time. It's a statement of something that has to be true in all times and all places. So when I accept that 1 and 1 is 2 is a self-evident truth, I'm saying it always was and it always will be, and it is so everywhere. Of course, we can see with our eyes that one thing and another thing make 2 things, but how do we know they always will under every sort of condition? We don't gather that information with our eyes or our experience. We can't experience what things were like 1 million years ago, and we can't experience what they're going to be like 1 million years from now. So we don't get the all that stands in front of every law statement, right? All bachelors are unmarried. How do you know that? Well, of course, in that case, it's because bachelor means an unmarried man who's otherwise eligible to marry. Some of the examples are trivial, and I'm trying to keep them simple, but Aristotle wants very much to say there are self-evident truths, and he depends very much on it, and he gives an argument that unless some things are self-evident, we know them without proof, we can never get proof of anything, because the very laws of logic have to be seen as self-evident also. The fundamental law of logic, I've given this to you before, nothing can be both true and false in the same sense at the same time. How do you know that was true 1 billion years ago? How do you know it will be true 1,565 years from now? And the answer, the only answer, is it's self-evident. It has, I experience it as having that ring of truth to it, of impressing itself on me as something that cannot fail to be true. So he says it has to be a law also. And then finally, the third restriction that he, excuse me, that he puts on these is that if it is something everybody sees, and it is a law, it is infallible. Wow. That means it can't possibly be false. Can't possibly be. So, no matter how I come by these truths, if I have really self-evident truths, then they're also going to meet the restrictions that were put on them. Now, but I have to tell you that these restrictions, since they had Aristotle's authority behind them persisted century after century after century. And when René Descartes comes on the scene, he's read Aristotle, of course, he not only accepts these restrictions, these extra restrictions, he makes them tighter. In my view, he makes them worse. What Descartes says here is not everyone who is an expert in the field. In which the self-evident truth is experienced. No, Descartes says, everyone who is in the least degree rational. Everyone who is in the least degree rational. So in Descartes' view, if something is a genuine self-evident truth, if it's prima facie true to me, it's not inferred from other information, I can't derive it from any other information, then if I'm in the least degree rational, and it really is a self-evident truth, I'll see it as such. And all people who are in the least degree rational, he's trying to rule out here people who may be insane or retarded or something, and have some mental defect, so they're not normal. But any normal person who is in the least degree rational is going to see it, provided they understand it, of course. And then it's also going to be a law, and it's going to be infallible. It just can't be wrong. Descartes adds, things that we see by intuition, and this is a kind of intuition, right? A direct seeing of the truth. Things that are seen that way are infallibly true. Wow. That Locke wants to attack. And he thinks that he can defeat that, this idea of self-evidency, by giving an explanation of how ideas reach our minds. And his account of that, as we saw last time, is that the mind is like a camera, a little dark room that has slits that lets in sensations. It lets in colors, tastes, touches, sounds, smells. And they all come from different slits because they are delivered by different senses. They're delivered by eyes, tongues, the organs of touch, and the taste, smells, and so on. So these things come in piecemeal. And our minds put them together into the objects that we perceive. And that's how all information gets in our mind. And he thinks that that will rebut self-evidence. I don't see how it does. And neither did Leibniz. Leibniz wrote an extensive rebuttal of Locke, line by line, line by line, of Locke's book, and defended the notion that there still were, he's right about sensation, but there still are self-evident truths that we grasp. 1 and 1 is 2. Mainly under self-evident truths, what the rationalists wanted to justify was logic and mathematics, which they saw as largely the same thing, and belief in God. Both of those can be and are self-evident. And Locke wants to say, no, all that comes into our minds are sensations. We put them together into the objects we perceive, and you can't say that these are self-evident because they're the same ones aren't self-evident to everybody, and they aren't laws, see, and they aren't infallible. We can make mistakes about them. And some sensations that reach our minds are intrinsically misleading, like hallucinations and holographs, realistic dreams. So these perceptions don't qualify as self-evident in Locke's view. He wants to say nothing does, but in fact he accepts logic and uses it, and he hasn't got any justification for that other than self-evidence. Now, let's pause for a moment and reflect on why it is that I think these three extra restrictions are one and all nonsense. Take number one. If you see something as being self-evident, suppose I put a logical formula on the board, and it's a tautology. If you understand it correctly, it can't be false. We could pick everything is visible or it's not, because that's one that is in the New Testament, and I've appealed to it several times. That's a tautology. That can't be false. So I look at that and I say, yep, that's self-evident to me. But suppose it's not to someone else. Someone else looks at it and says, I don't know, I don't get that. Why should I concede that that's a self-evident truth? And rejects it. Well, then according to Aristotle's restrictions, it's not really self-evident when it bloody well is. Or take one and one is two if you don't like the illustration about being visible or not. One and one is two. It can't be anything else. It never has been anything else. It never will be. All right. How do I know that everybody who ever lived agreed with that? And whoever will live will agree with that. How could I know that? But that's what this restriction demands. The first one that's crossed out. Everyone who is in the least degree rational sees its truth and its self-evidence. But I don't know that. How am I going to find that out? As I said, universal proposition is one that has all in front of it. And all means everywhere and at all times. But I can't know the distant past or the far distant future. And why isn't it the case anyway that some things are self-evident to us that may not be shared by anybody else? Suppose my dear aunt, whom I love and whom I help take care of in her old age, has a mole on her shoulder and it embarrasses her, so she constantly keeps it covered. She's always has some clothing that covers that mole whenever she meets anyone else. And I'm the only person besides herself who knows she has it. It's self-evident to me that she has a mole on her shoulder. It's a normal sense perception, and that's a fact that she has a mole. And she dies and is cremated, and nobody else ever sees the mole. Why should that mean that wasn't self-evident to me? I think that's absurd. Look at the second one. It has to be a law. Who says it has to be a law? Isn't normal sense perception, our experience of the world around us every day, also self-evident to us that those things that we experience are real and that they're where we see them? If I'm stopped at a traffic light and the light changes and turns green, that means I can go. But I look to see if anybody's violating their red light just the same. And all of that I take to be real. I don't take it to be a dream. I understand what I'm seeing to be real in the sense that if I pull out and another car is continuing to come, I may seriously be injured or killed. Why doesn't that count as self-evident? Why would self-evidence have to be true only of laws? Surely there are laws that are self-evident. I think there are others that are not. And I think many things that are not laws are self-evident. Whenever we're giving an account of how we know something and we come back to the point where the only way to know what we're talking about is that we experience it or we don't, then we've come at a dead end so far as proving or demonstrating anything is true. We have to say, you have to experience this. And if we've reached that point, it could only be because it's self-evident. In the senses in which Aristotle recognized were true in the first place, that it's prima facie true and not inferred from other information. That sounds good. But these other things, these other restrictions, sound bogus. The third restriction is that it has to yield knowledge that is infallible. Now, infallible means that we have a power, self-evidence, our self-evidence intuitions, are a power that we possess that deliver truth and only truth. And they cannot be mistaken. I think my first objection to that is that, given my, comes out of my Christian background, because the story in Genesis of Adam and Eve violating God's law that he laid down for them makes it pretty clear that only God is infallible. You know, we may like to think, some of us may like to think we have some power of knowing or perceiving it can't be wrong, but why would we think that? From the very beginning, people had powers of observation and perception and reasoning, but got things pretty fouled up anyway. I think we leave infallibility to God alone. But there's more than that. Infallible can't possibly be wrong. Well, that's very much tied to its being a law. See, this one follows from this one. Because if it's a law, it's universally true. And therefore, it would turn out to be infallible. But the tough part about it is, it requires, it implies logically, that humans have some power of knowledge that is, that cannot possibly make a mistake. And I can't think of any evidence for that at all. Suppose we talk about this intuitive grasp of self-evidence as our self-evidency antennae. There are antennas that come out and pick up things as being self-evident. Our self-evidency antennae are not infallible because there are people that have defended certain propositions and beliefs as true and as self-evident that have decisively been shown to be false. So why should we think that ability of ours can't possibly be mistaken? But Aristotle, Descartes reaffirms what Aristotle had said. Yes, we do. What is delivered to us by intuition, Descartes says, cannot be mistaken. It has to be true. Yeah? No evidence for it and tons against it. And no evidence for that claim. I think things are self-evident to us, and there are many things we can't know any other way, like the laws of logic. And we need them, but it doesn't make us infallible in any of our powers of observation and knowledge. Not a bit. So that's my take on self-evidence. It means that while I'm going to agree with Leibniz against Locke, that we know things to be self-evident, and that includes even the perceptions that Locke is saying come through the slits in the little dark room that is our minds and write on a blank tablet there, includes them, they're self-evident to us also, but not infallibly so. I can see something and be confused about what I'm seeing. I can make an error in judgment. Always possible. And it includes the laws of logic, which was what Leibniz wanted to make sure we're not endangered. After all, Locke uses logic all the time to make his theories and argue for them. So he's accepting them. And on what grounds? And Leibniz points out that he can't give us any other grounds than the intuition of self-evidence. Why? How else can he defend the laws of logic? He can't defend them using the laws of logic, because that would beg the question. That would assume they're already true. And the answer, of course, is they look on the face of it true, and I can't imagine or conceive of how it could be false. How could anything be both true and false in the same sense at the same time? Can't be. Okay. A bit of an excursus, but a needed one. We need to see what Locke was trying to do and what Leibniz was trying to prevent him from doing. So, I want you to hear Locke, in his own words, tell us about this theory of his. I brought some Locke with me today. Here we are. All ideas come from sensation or reflection. That means reflecting on what we've sensed. Let us then suppose the mind to be, as we say, a white paper, void of all characters, without any ideas. How does it come to be furnished? Whence has it all the materials of reason and knowledge? To this I answer, in one word, from experience. I think that's right. But then he goes on to foul up what counts as experience. In all our knowledge is founded, and from it it is ultimately derived. Our observation employed either about external sensible objects or about the internal operations of our mind perceived and reflected on by ourselves is that which supplies our understandings with all the materials of thinking. These two are the fountains of knowledge from which all ideas that we have, or naturally can have, spring. The objects of sensation are, first of all, our senses are acquainted with particular sensible objects and convey into the mind several distinct perceptions of things according to those ways wherein those objects affect them. That's what I'm saying, that it's why he thinks that what we experience by sense perception, what first enters our mind, is not, say, an image of a house or a car or a tree or a landscape. It's color sensations, auditory sensations, tactile sensations, gustatory sensations, and so on, because they come through different senses. So it has to be that we experience these sensations. They come in separately, and our minds put them together, meld them into objects. Thus we come by those ideas that we have, say, of yellow, white, heat, cold, soft, bitter, or sweet. And all of these we call sensible qualities. I use the term sensory, or what was the other term? Phenomenal properties. What we see on the surface of our experience. Which, when I say the senses convey these into the mind, I mean from external objects conveyed by what the mind produces in those perceptions. So here we get again the copy theory of perception. What occurs in our minds are little tiny copies of what's going on outside in the real world. Secondly, the other fountain from which experience furnishes our understanding with ideas is the perception of the operation of our own mind within us. It's employed about the ideas it has got. Which operations, when the soul comes to reflect on and consider them, furnish the understanding with another set of ideas, which could not be had from thinking about things external to us. And they are things such as perception, thinking, doubting, believing, reasoning, knowing, willing, and all the different actions of our own minds, which we, being conscious of and observing in ourselves, do from these receive our understanding as distinct ideas, as distinct as our bodies are from our minds. And I call this reflection. The ideas it affords being only as the mind gets by reflecting on its own operations within itself. These two, I say, sensation and reflection, as the objects of sensation and reflection, are to me the only original sources from which all our ideas take their beginnings. Now, I think that contains a mistake, but it's not terrible. The idea, what he's saying here is experience. And experience can be of the external world, and these he calls perceptions, or of our own minds, or put of how our own minds operate. Okay, so this much I'd agree with. So what's the problem? Well, the problem isn't so much with two. I think you have to say a good bit more about it, but it's with one. Because he takes the sensations of the external world not to be sensations of this chair, this table, this house, this crowd of people, the road with the cars in it. No, it's not of the objects. The sensations of the external world are things such as color patches, sounds, smells, tastes, and I'll call them touches, tactile properties. This feels smooth and cool, for example, right now, desktop. Those come in disparately. And then our minds put them together. Wait a minute. You say, he's trying to describe the operation of our minds. I've never experienced that. When I reflect on my mind, what I see, the conclusion I come to is, I perceive entire objects. The wall, the ceiling, the cars outside the window, and so on. And I think that's right. And he's wrong. We don't experience color patches, individual sounds, taste, touch, smells, and then put them together into an object. here's the guy who's saying these are the only two ways information comes to us, by sensation or by reflecting on how our minds operate. But he can't, with his bare face hanging out, tell me that we all experience disparate sense perceptions. And then, by an unconscious activity of the mind, put them together into things. Whoa, wait a minute. He's the guy that's against unconscious things, right? He doesn't like it when Leibniz writes that we have the experience of self-evidence. Whether we're conscious of that or not, we take normal perception to be self-evident. We take the axioms of logic to be self-evident, even if we've never heard that term. It just means they're not proven on the basis of anything else. They're directly experienced to be true, period. Well, we have that experience, but we cannot isolate and point to the experience of piecing together distinct and separate little sensations so that they together make an object. No, what we experience are the objects. And we abstract from them that among other kinds of properties they exhibit taste, colors, sounds, touches, and smells, the sensory properties. They're just one kind of properties that what we perceive exhibit. And you say, well, what other kinds? Well, what we perceive exhibits quantity, how much. It can be numbered, counted. What we perceive exhibits spatiality. It has a shape, a size, a location. What we experience has physical properties, weight, mass, density. What we experience has logical properties. It can be distinguished, abstracted from, conceived. We can form a concept of it. It has linguistic properties. It can be named. And it has a great deal more. I think that those things that we perceive have, for example, social properties and economic properties, ethical properties, at least potentially, you see. They can, a rock, it has its quantity and its spatial size location and its physical properties, I will say actively, because it has those independently of whether anybody knows it. It doesn't depend on anyone else to have those properties, and therefore it possesses those actively. But it is only passive perceptually. It has color, taste, touch, sound, smell, but only in relation to us when we perceive it. So those things are only potential. They're not actual or active. They're passive, and they're known in the passive relation of being our objects of perception. Same thing for conception. We have a concept of a rock, but the rock doesn't have any logical properties. It doesn't think. It doesn't have any actively, but passively. Yeah, passively it can be distinguished from other objects around us. It can be defined, it can be conceived, and so on. So things have their properties actively or passively. The ones that they have passively are all the kinds of properties and laws we find in the universe. The active versus passive ones are that they have some properties that exhibit themselves only in relation to us. So I think that's a legitimate reply to the different ways that things possess their properties, actively or passively. The passive ones are passive until we activate them. We think of them. Or some other creature does. Animals can do it too. A rock, for example, I said, has quantity, spatial size and location, physical solidity and mass and weight and density and so on. But a tiny rock can be swallowed by a bird, go into its gizzard, and help to digest its food. It has a passive biotic property that's activated only in relation to the bird making that use of it. Or the bird may take a clam, fly up high and drop it on the rock to open it, come down and eat the clam. It's using that rock as part of its biological milieu, and that's a passive property that the rock has, activated by the bird. I won't go on with this because this is not the time or place to spell out an alternative philosophy, but it seems to me that those are fairly obvious points and that they seriously disagree with this one part of Locke's account. Do we have perceptions of the world around us? Absolutely. And do those come to us from things that are distinct from us? Absolutely. Can we reflect on how our own minds operate? Yes, we can. But then, if we reflect on how our own minds operate, we never find the activity of piecing together a bunch of disparate sensations so as to form an object. That we don't do. What we can be conscious of is the reverse. We experience entire objects and we abstract different kinds of properties from them, which is how he came to this idea of sensations in the first place. So there are two really important points of disagreement with Locke. The first is that experience means sensations with only, and he calls them sensitive. I call them sensory, and other people have called them phenomenal properties. In other words, sensations only have color, sound, taste, touch, smell. But that's not an accurate description of what you and I experience by perception all day, every day. No, what we experience are landscapes and streets and cars and houses and people and whole objects that have way more than just sensory properties. See, it's a fateful equivocation on this term sensory. You can use that to talk about the senses, seeing, hearing, tasting, touching. But from that, it doesn't follow that what passes through them to us, to our minds, is only sensory properties. That's a specific kind, distinguished from the other kinds that we experience. What other kinds? I'll put it down again. Quantitative. Spatial, kinematic, things move and change and remain the same. Physical, biotic. Here's the sensory kind of properties. All of these are kinds of properties and laws. Okay? And we could go on to name more, but more have been distinguished by different sciences and by many thinkers over centuries. Not only sensory properties, but logical. And I'm going to call it technical. That is, this has to do with the human ability to take a raw material and make something new out of it, calling that technical. And that includes, as one of the first things humans do that to, linguistic. Humans take sounds and signs that they can draw to symbolically represent something else, and we have beginnings of language, and it can have linguistic properties, and on the basis of that, they can have social. There are standards of politeness and so on. And it can have, I'm just going to name these randomly, economic properties and ethical. We experience some actions to be intrinsically bad, wrong to do. People shouldn't be doing that kind of stuff. Sure we do. And the distinction between a thing's being ethically wrong and a thing's being red or warm or solid or so many feet away, they're all different kinds of properties, of things that we experience and exhibit. And nobody can doubt that. That's what that we all experience all every day and all the time. We can abstract these kinds of properties and laws from that, from the objects that we perceive. But experiences of whole objects in a multiplicity of kinds of properties. So I'm going to use the term for that I'm going to use is a concrete, I'll call it, a concrete object. And that means that we it is perceived as having a multiplicity of kinds of properties and laws. So by this I mean, I'm hyphenating properties and laws because I mean that the laws are the laws that relate those that kind of properties. And my contention is that's what we really experience, concrete objects around us. And we abstract from them these various kinds of properties and laws. You don't have to agree with my list. It doesn't matter what list of kinds of properties you come up with. The same problems result from that, and the same benefits result from that, of list to list. So we have Locke here preaching this gospel of experience as the foundation of all knowledge. Whether that's the experience of external objects or that's the experience of how our minds operate, that's all that gets into this little room. And Leibniz is saying, wait a minute, pal, you're forgetting that some of that stuff is experienced as self-evidently real, self-evidently true, self-evidently false. What's self-evidently true doesn't need proof. What's self-evidently false doesn't need a proof that it's false. If I say 1 + 1 = 6.5, you're not going to accept that. You're not going to believe it. And you don't need to construct a proof. It's not true. Don't toss out the over-dependence of the rationalists on what's self-evident when you come to emphasize, as a good empiricist, the experience that comes into our minds, that what is given to our consciousness is the world around us, as well as the operations of our own minds. So we can see Locke as a step in the right direction, and then the next step falters and gets ensnared in a bad mistake. And we'll come back and look at that in more detail next time. Meanwhile, do the reading, reflect on it, get the stuff down so that you can handle it on an essay or an exam. I want to see you all do extremely well in this course. See you later.